pleasure to be here in this Sabbath school, these bright, sharp, and mostly young minds. Pleasure to be back in Loma Linda. I left here 30 years ago for New Mexico and then on to Mongolia for 5 years and China for several years and then back to Maine, which is home now. But it's a pleasure to come here, and I'm just astonished at the number of people that I see, and after a moment, I recognize. It turns out that while I was growing older, maybe 25 years ago I left. But anyway, while I was growing older over the last 25 years, it turns out everyone else was as well. So it takes a moment, and then I go, oh, yeah, I know you. You know, oh, wow. It's fun. I like it. I want to talk with you this morning about watching. I want to talk to you this morning about watching for signs of the end. I want to talk to you this morning about what Christ told us to do. I want to talk to you this morning about signs that we have missed and what that means. But I want to start this morning by talking to you about my great-grandmother. My great-grandmother was only about this high. And she got shorter and shorter and shorter as she got older and older and over, bent over. But she was a force of nature. She had a hard upbringing. Hard upbringing. A coarse upbringing. She was not a Christian by any stretch of the imagination until she converted to Adventism in her mid-20s, as a matter of fact. And so if you irritated great-grandma, and there were four of us grandkids, we called her little grandma, by the way. She had a daughter who was much taller, and the grandmas would come and visit us, and we'd call them, with the simplicity of juvenile conceptual frameworks, we would call them big grandma and little grandma. But if you irritated little grandma sufficiently, and it didn't take that much, she could turn the air blue. She could let you know that she had come up hard, and then she would apologize sincerely. She had a golden heart. She loved Jesus. Now, when we were young, we were living in Loma Linda, as I say, four rambunctious boys, and we always knew when the grandmas were going to come and visit because there were certain preparations that were made. We were living on Lomas Verdes, if you know where that is, on the other side of Mountain View. Anyway, we would know when the grandmas were going to come and visit because the big red leather chair would be hauled out of my father's study and it would be placed by the fireplace. The fireplace that for all the rest of the time was dead, as it should be in Loma Linda. I mean, for crying out loud, why do they put fireplaces in houses in Southern California? I live in Maine now. We only heat with wood. We burn 8 cords of wood. We're pretty serious about it. Cut our own wood. But you guys, I mean, come on. What a fireplace. What's up with that? But anyway, so Grandma was coming, and she liked the house to be oppressively warm. And we would get a cord of dry eucalyptus. I mean, we're talking serious firewood here. So we'd get in the cord of firewood. We'd get that big red leather chair, put it right by the fireplace. We'd get a little table and put it by the red leather chair. We would get a small stand and get a black and white TV, which for some reason she preferred, put it right there in front of the chair. And she was all set up. The fire had to be going when little grandma got there. So the house, I mean, we kids, we just couldn't even stand to be in that house. That house was so warm. She'd always come during the winter. She'd come down from Tacoma, Washington. But the winters, of course, were warm enough without the fire. So anyway, Grandma would come, and she would settle into that chair. And as she got older and older, she lost more and more hair, and she got smaller. She'd settle into that chair. She'd look for all the world like a gnome. And she'd sit there doing her sewing, her knitting, watching her TV, drinking her coffee. Yeah, she was a coffee addict. And she would dispense wisdom from that chair whether you wanted it or not. She would hold court. There were many of the times when I was innocently walking past the chair and she'd grab me and give me a piece of advice. One piece of advice that I got often, I don't know why, but one piece of advice that I got often, she'd grab me, she'd say, "Scotty, you need to marry a pretty and hardworking girl." Well, okay, check, Grandma. I actually did that. And she was absolutely right. I actually appreciated the advice, though I had pretty much picked up on that clue on my own. There were other pieces of advice that were a bit more difficult. Now, my grandmother, her health began to decline, of course, as everyone's does eventually. So she would come down with her medicines. She would come down with everything she needed to stay at our place for like 2 months. 2 months. Anyway, so she'd stay, and she'd bring stuff, and she had these coughing fits that would go on and on and on, and she had this medicine that she called Green Thunder. And I don't know what was in there, but you can imagine. And I had no idea. Now, you remember, some of you, back in the day, that when you used to go to the pharmacy, you would get your medicine in either plastic or glass, brown or clear bottle, right? They slapped the label on there. We're talking 60s and 70s here back in the day. I had no idea that those came in the 2-liter size. It was huge, you know? But she had that there. And she'd get this coughing fit, and she'd have her Green Thunder, and she'd have, I'm almost tempted to say a tumbler, but she had a glass there, and she'd cough and cough and cough, and finally, with great reluctance, she'd trembling, she'd reach into her bag, she'd uncap that huge bottle, she'd pour it out, and she, in one go, and she'd go, and then would come the advice. And she would say, "Scotty, don't ever grow old, it's the pits." Well, there is gray in the beard. You know, some advice you can take, some you can't take. And I'd like to take that advice. I really would, but I can't. There was another time, or other times, when she gave me advice more frequently than any other. She gave me advice. She would grab me as I was walking by, and she would she'd pull me down so she could look me in the eye. And she would say, "Scotty, watch for Jesus, because you will see him coming. We will see him coming." My grandmother was my great-grandmother was a very sincere convert to Adventism. Whatever she did with her heart. She absolutely believed that she would see Christ coming. She absolutely watched for Christ. She watched for the signs. Ultimately, she was wrong. She went to her rest in 1997 at the age of 99. My grandmother, big grandma, converted to Adventism along with my great-grandmother, though my grandmother at the time was 10. The two were just 16 years apart, part of my grandmother's, great-grandmother's hard upbringing. But my grandmother also believed that she would see Christ come. But perhaps as a function of personality, perhaps as a function of upbringing, perhaps as a function of her taking in the culture in which she lived, what she believed in a drier fashion, a more intellectual fashion, a calmer, passionless, almost passionless fashion. She believed Christ would come, yes. She believed that she would see him. She ultimately was wrong. She was laid to her rest a few years ago at 89 years of age. My father, who works 2 days a week over at the dental school, Dr. Christensen, Ed Christensen, if anyone knows him, is convinced still that he will see Jesus come. But he thinks that Jesus better hurry up, because at 76 he doesn't have that much longer. Now, my grandmother, my great-grandmother, my grandmother, my father, all believe that they will see Jesus come, all believe that they would see Jesus come on the basis of seeing more sin in mankind, seeing the world become coarser and rougher and brutal, and basically saying, how much more can the world take? How much longer can this go on? Now, I too believe that I will see Jesus come in my lifetime. Ultimately, I may be wrong, but I believe that I will see Jesus come in my lifetime. But I have a completely different set of metrics. Yes, I believe that one of the indications of Christ's coming that we see is the waxing of sinfulness in this world. It's a primary indicator, right? Well, we've seen that for 6,000, well, we haven't seen it, but it's been going on for 6,000 years. I accept that metric, but I'm also looking at other metrics that we have not looked at. Now, last night, some of you were able to come out to the Planet in Distress seminar that we held last night. The first half, have the second half this afternoon, 4 o'clock over at Cutler. But we talked about the tremendous and accelerating decay of our natural systems that God created. I talked for 90 minutes, and don't worry, I'm not going to do that this morning, but I can just give you just a taste of what we were talking about. We were talking about systems that underpin the functioning of the world, that were created in perfection. Our atmospheric system, our climate system, our food production system, otherwise known as soil and its subsystems and its related relation to the other systems, our freshwater system, our oceanic system. And we talked about how every one of these systems is in dramatic and accelerating decline, that we can actually observe the decline of the physical earth. It's happening fast enough that we can observe it in the course of our lifetimes, and that it's being observed all over the world. And in the case of the ocean, the best measured system, the one with which man has the most intimate relationship, the oceans are in staggering decline. Commercial fish species will essentially disappear within the next 25 years is what the best science says. 1 billion people rely on the ocean as their primary source of food. We were looking at all of these systems in great detail, some of them in great detail last night. And the important thing about these systems is that our global complex society, which we'll be talking about this afternoon, our global complex society is built four square on these systems. As we see the effect of sin, this is not an environmental thing, by the way. Am I an environmentalist? Yes, in the sense that I love the earth that God created and can hardly wait to see it created anew, where it's even better. Am I an environmentalist in the sense that we need to save the earth? No. You can think that's good, you can think that's bad. But you know, not even God will save the earth. He will destroy it and recreate it. Only people can be saved from this earth. So here's the thing. Society is built four square on these systems that are collapsing. And we can see right now significant stresses in society that are a result of our rapidly declining global systems. In fact, the global systems that are in accelerating decline. I'll give you a couple examples. Syria. There's trouble in Syria, right? Well, there's 100,000 people that are dead in the last couple years. Now, if that's not trouble, I don't know what counts as trouble. Huge trouble. You've heard about now there's problems in Egypt, right? Problems in the Middle East generally, right? Yemen, Tunisia, Libya. Have you ever heard? You've heard of Arab Spring. You're well-educated adults. You watch some media, I trust. You've heard of Arab Spring. What we don't generally understand, but what is very well studied in science and a number of articles written on, is that the Arab Spring was not triggered by some spontaneous mass desire for democracy. We'd like to believe that. Okay, you know, and that's fine. But that's not what did it. Yes, these people were living under despotic governments. Yes, they were having miserable lives. Yes, they were oppressed. Yes, they wanted better. But it had been that way for generations. So why, all of a sudden, was there this great, dramatic Arab Spring, which has ended up costing well over 100,000 lives when you count Libya and elsewhere, and where in Egypt it's far from settled? What did it? Well, you have to go back to 2006. Starting in 2006, there was a historic drought that settled on the Middle East. And ground zero was Syria. And this drought is the worst in the recorded history of the Fertile Crescent. And that's an awful lot of recorded history. And what happened starting in 2006 is that crops failed. Not just a little bit, they failed dramatically. The drought was punishing. It was horrible. Poor people, relatively poor people, who had small amounts of agriculture going on and who had herds that they grazed around. They weren't raising hay. They grazed these where they could. These people lost everything. The crops failed. There was nothing to eat for the herds, and so they had to either slaughter them or try and baby them through to the next year, except the next year was the same thing. Crops absolutely failed. What was left of the herds were dying off. As a result of that, people who had nothing to begin with now had absolutely nothing. Do we sell the little bit of furniture that we have to buy seed to plant a crop? But the third year it was the same. And the fourth year it was the same. The price of food absolutely shot up. The price of food in starting in 2007 through 2011 shot up 70%. And you didn't even notice. That was not just a Middle East phenomenon. That was a global phenomenon. In the Middle East, it was closer to 100% because of local shortages. A food price spike that you didn't even notice. Because when you buy your box of cornflakes and pay $4 for it, in that box of cornflakes is a handful of corn and a handful of sugar. That's about what you get. And the corn is devoid of nutrients, by the way. And there's none in the sugar. But that's about 20 cents worth of food. And you're paying $4 for all sorts of other things. Luxury housing for Tony the Tiger, marketing, transportation, all of this stuff. But for the 3.5 billion people on the face of the earth who are making $2.50 a day or less, sometimes much, much less, when this little bit of food that is all they can buy every day goes up 70% or 100%, this is all they can get. And they become very, very, very unhappy. This was not just a Middle Eastern phenomenon. It was a global phenomenon. And it is still reverberating around the globe. But what happens when you get a food price spike and you are miserable in the first place is that you just don't take it anymore. Where there were despotic governments, not just the Middle East, where there were situations that were incredibly difficult, people rose up. There were riots. There were rebellions. There were governments overthrown. There was death. In Syria, this is what triggered the rebellion in Syria. People got to the point where they just couldn't take it, and they started openly saying it in the streets, and for their trouble they were shot, and things unraveled from there. What we see are climate shifts, which among just one of the systems, of the several systems that are in steep and accelerating decline, we see climate shifts that affect the systems on which our societies are built. And from that, we see conflict in society. We see increases in disease, especially where there's water shortages. We see pestilence. We see Matthew 24, 6 through 8. Turn with me if you have your Bibles. Matthew Matthew 24, 6 through 8. I don't know why I'm turning to it. I think I can just repeat it. And ye shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. There will be famines, pestilences, and earthquakes in various places. All these are the beginning of sorrows. This afternoon, 4 o'clock, one of the things we'll do is really unpack that verse. But here's the thing. Sin affects the actual physical earth. When man sinned, his dominion over the earth passed to his conqueror, Satan. When Satan came between the Creator and creation, the result of sin was death to man, to animals, to the earth itself, to these systems that were created in perfection. You cannot separate creation from Creator and expect it to go on. And this society that we have, these wonderful, and I really admire this new centennial complex, this building that we have, this air conditioned, those of you who drove here in air conditioned cars, I foolishly walked in a heavy wool suit. It was, anyway, it was a bad, I'd forgotten what it was like to live in California. I don't know. But those of you who walked, you know, and we go to the market, we've got all this food, we live in a wealthy society, we have, in essence, insulated ourselves from God. And we've also insulated ourselves from His creation. We're in here, God's up there, nature's out there, and we just like it that way. As a society, not necessarily as this church or as this Adventist community, but as a global society, if God's anywhere, we want Him up there, we want Him away. But that's not how it is. Our society, again, rests four square on the systems that were created and the systems that are dying. And that is pushing the fulfillment of prophecy now. We are at the point where we can see on a global basis where there's stresses. We know where the water's lacking. We know how fast it's going away. We know which aquifers are being pumped dry. We know where the agriculture is failing. We know where there are climate refugees. We know where there are flashpoints. We can not only chart and graph the fulfillment of prophecy in real time, but we can predict its coming. Now, what would the people of my great-grandmother's generation say, the Adventists, those sincere Adventists, if they were living now and they saw prophecy being fulfilled? Signs that we are not even awake to. Not only them. What about the founders of the Adventist Church? People who, some of them, who honestly and sincerely stood in their cornfields and potato fields in October of 1844 and waited and watched for Christ to come and were disappointed. In some sense, as my great-grandmother and grandmother were disappointed, but they were disappointed and lived through it and eventually regrouped and realized their mistake. But when they founded the Adventist Church, they did not found it on dry theology. They founded it on a passion that Christ was coming soon. They founded it on the belief that they would see Him come. They were wrong. But here's the thing, brothers and sisters. A couple things. From generation to generation to generation, we seem to have done some of the exact same things that the nation of Israel did, some of the exact same things we've criticized them for. We seem to have gone from conviction to tradition. We seem to have gone from a church that was on fire, that dedicated its time, that dedicated its resources, that was willing to knock on a door and be embarrassed for God. Something almost no one of this generation is willing to do. Christ told us to watch. Let's take a look at Mark 13. I'm going to read from 32 to 37. And I want you to count with me the number of times in this particular verse that we are told to watch. But of that day and hour, oh, by the way, if you were in Jonathan's class, to my dismay, he read this during Sabbath school. So you can sleep through this part, maybe, but I'm only going to be doing it for a minute, so it's a short nap. Anyway, no, this wasn't what he read. He read Matthew 24. I apologize. Okay, anyway, 25. But of that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. Take heed, watch, and pray. For you do not know when the time is. It is like a man going to a far country who left his house and gave authority to his servants. Who's the man that went to the far country? And who's the servants? Okay. Like a man who went to a far country, left his house and gave authority to his servants and to each his work and commanded the doorkeeper to watch. Watch, therefore. For you do not know when the master of the house is coming, in the evening, at midnight, at the crowing of the rooster, or in the morning, lest coming suddenly he find you sleeping. And what I say to you, I say to all, watch. Did I read that last verse correctly? Obviously it's a trick question, so don't answer it. If you have a New King James Version, as I do, you will notice that the team of translators who put this translation together and who were figuring things out decided that there was an exclamation point after the final watch, that the language and the context required this exclamation point. That was their decision. And what I say to you, I say to all, watch! Now, to understand the importance of that, you have to compare it to the other things this team of translators did. If you have time sometime, on a Sabbath afternoon, especially if you have a red letter edition, which makes it real easy, go through Mark or go through Matthew, even better, in the New King James Version, and see where they decided to put exclamation points when Christ was talking. And yes, this is Christ speaking in Mark 13. And what you notice is that Christ frequently spoke with exclamation points when he was speaking a parable and when he was in third person, when he's speaking for one of the characters. Because his characters, like in every good story, his characters had action. You know, his characters did stuff. And so, yeah, there's an exclamation point there. Christ also is quoted using exclamation points when he's talking to the scribes and Pharisees. Oh, you whitened sepulchres! Oh, you brood of vipers! And I can't argue with the use of exclamation points there. Absolutely belongs. I see Christ shouting those things. But how often, when speaking plainly, and when speaking unemotionally, and when talking to his disciples and giving a direct command, which, if it were a direct command to his disciples, is a direct command to us, how often does Christ use, or is Christ quoted using an exclamation point? Go and look. This is an exceptional verse. We are told to watch. Why? Well, one reason is because we become like what we watch. If we're watching the world, you know, is the are my clothes right? Are my shoes? Oh, my shoes aren't that shiny. Live on a farm in Maine. That's the only excuse I have. Thank goodness I have that excuse. If we're watching the world, how about my car? How about my job? How about my career? How about my status? How about my teeth? Maybe I should have them whitened. How about my haircut? Maybe I shouldn't have mentioned that. I walked here. But if we're watching the world, the entertainments of the world, the distractions of the world, the metrics of the world where we measure ourselves in comparison to others, if we're watching the metrics of the world, we will become more and more and more like the world, and we will grow colder and colder to Christ. And that's an easy thing to do in the Christian and Adventist society, the comfortable Christian and Adventist society in the world today. But if time is really short, can we afford to do that? And the other thing is, if we're watching the world, we can't even see the signs of Christ coming because we're not watching for them. One of the functions of watching for Christ is that you see things other people don't. Now, you're not hallucinating, but you're looking for them. You're watching. You are analyzing, and therefore you are seeing. Things which the world will not perceive, we see. If this generation can actually see the fulfillment of prophecy in real time, if we see things our ancestors wished they could be alive to see, if we are living in this tremendous age of terrible responsibility, do we have a sense of urgency that matches the day in which we live? Or are we asleep? Go back to Matthew 24 with me. The context of Matthew 24 is that Christ's disciples had come to him after Christ had earlier said that terrible things would happen. And they come to him privately and they say, "Master, tell us, tell us about these things. You've got us kind of rattled here. Tell us about this." And Christ does. He lays out logically, in great detail, in significant detail, what will happen in the last days. He, and typical of prophecy, he laid out what would happen in a relatively short term to Jerusalem, but also what our experience would be in the last days. It has a dual application. And Matthew 24 is a chapter that is worth reading. I'm kind of an end-timey guy, so take it with a grain of salt, but if it's something that's worth reading every month to keep us focused. I mean, just to get in there and say, yeah. Well, these are Christ's words telling us to watch and telling us what to watch for. If you go into later in the chapter in Matthew 24, verse 42. If you go to verse 42, you notice that we just read that over in Mark. So yes, this is the exact same stuff, but it's better in Mark. Both disciples were recounting what Christ said, but we get more detail in Mark, so we read it from there. But it was important enough that both disciples recorded it. Now I want to go to Matthew 25, where Jonathan was spending some time this morning in his Sabbath school class. And, when there were chapters and verses put into the Bible, they were put in according to their best judgment, but the Bible didn't start out that way. They were added later. And so we're looking at this, and it's important. It's not that we got a new chapter and there's suddenly a new scene someplace else, like a new scene in a movie, that the action has been moved, that it's unrelated to what has gone before. What happened between chapter 24 and chapter 25 is that Christ took a breath. This is all one thought. This is all one thing that he is trying to tell his disciples. What will happen in the end days? The first part of chapter 25 goes with chapter 24. So let's read it. Chapter 25. "Then the kingdom of heaven shall be likened to 10 virgins." Oh, I know that story. This is preached a lot. "Who took their lamps and went out to meet the bridegroom. Now 5 of them were wise and 5 of them were foolish. Those who were foolish took their lamps and took no oil with them." What's oil? Holy Spirit. Good class. All right, you get A's. "But the wise took no oil in their vessels with their lamps. And while the bridegroom..." Who's the bridegroom?
Jesus.
There you go. Bridegroom is Jesus. "While the bridegroom was delayed..." Brothers and sisters, we are in the tarrying time. Through mercy, and we'll discuss that a little bit this afternoon, through mercy, God is waiting until the very last second to save the maximum number of souls. We are in the tarrying time, but there's a limit. That tarrying time will end. Prophecy will be fulfilled. "But while the bridegroom was delayed, they all slumbered and slept." How many slumbered? Are we the Laodicean church?
Yes.
Are we asleep?
Yes.
Is that right? Christ said it would happen. That's actually cold comfort. And at midnight a cry was heard, "Behold, the bridegroom is coming, go out to meet him." There's so much that could be preached here, but I'm going to resist the temptation given the time, and I'm going to go through to my point. "Then all those virgins arose and trimmed their lamps." Excuse me. "And the foolish said to the wise," I'm very sorry, fighting a cold here, "said to the wise, 'Give us some of your oil, for our lamps are going out.' But the wise answered, saying, 'No, lest there should not be enough for us and you. But go rather to those who sell and buy for yourselves.' And while they went to buy, the bridegroom came, and those who were ready went in to meet him, in with him to the wedding, and the door was shut. Afterward, the other virgins came also, saying, 'Lord, Lord, open to us.' But he answered and said, 'Assuredly, I say to you, I do not know you.'" Watch therefore, verse 13, "for you know neither the day nor the hour in which the Son of Man is coming." This is all one thought, all of chapter 24, where he's telling us what will happen. And then he tells us we've got to watch. We've got to watch. We've got to watch. Right now, there are 15 countries in which the prophecies, Christ's prophecies in Matthew 24, 6 through 8, have been fully fulfilled. And more countries are being added to that list. Haiti, Syria, Egypt, I think we can put in that category. I'll be talking about those 15 countries this afternoon. We are seeing prophecy fulfilled. Are we watching? Are we even awake? Ellen White has something to say on this. Great Controversy, 88 edition, page 370. "Though no man knoweth the day nor the hour of his coming, we are instructed and required to know when it is near. We are further taught that to disregard his warning and refuse or neglect to know when his advent is near will be as fatal to us as it was for those who lived in the days of Noah, not to know when the flood is coming." Are we comfortable? Are we watching the world? Are we content with tradition? Have we given up on pursuing conviction and passion? Are we tied enough to the world that we don't want to be on fire for Christ because, my goodness, that would be embarrassing to be talking to other people about Jesus all the time. I've seen nuts like that. I don't want to be one of those. Those who deny Christ will be denied by Christ. Brothers and sisters, we're seeing in real time what the founders of this church, what would have had their hair on fire. We'll be talking about it more this afternoon. We'll be talking about whether or not our sense of urgency matches the moment and what we should be doing. Thank you.
This media was brought to you by Audioverse, a website dedicated to spreading God's word through free sermon audio and much more. If you would like to know more about Audioverse, or if you would like to listen to more sermons, please visit www.audioverse.org.